I call this meeting of the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy to order. There isn't a quorum present at the moment, so what I would like to do in the meantime is refer everyone to your folder and to look at the committee's rules. It should be in your red save folder. We made a couple of changes to the committee rules. And I would like to point to Rule 7. All right, so maybe we can look over that real quick. And substantive amendments are to be received by the committee administrator, who is Chris McCall to my right here, electronic format 24 hours before the committee meeting in which a bill is scheduled to be heard. Amendments to amendments must be received electronically by the committee administrator no later than 2 hours before the bill's scheduled committee hearing begins. And I, as the chair, has the prerogative to allow amendments of a corrective or technical nature during a hearing that have not met this rule by my discretion. So that would be this minor technical and small, narrow amendments that may be referenced by maybe something that House Research has shared with us that we need to amend, but very narrow in scope.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, with regard to that, then, Representative Keel raised a question, a point of order on the House floor yesterday of Speaker Hortman with regard to the bill that we are to hear tomorrow in committee, House File 400. That bill was released on Monday at 1:53. My first question to you is, did you have any versions of that language prior to it being released to the public that could have been shared with the public so that we could have had a heads up in terms of anticipating a possible amendments that we might have offered tomorrow on the bill?
Representative Albright, well, that was a bill that had been worked on by the author of that bill. What we do know is it is a big bill in many ways, but what she has done, and I believe what you will find come tomorrow on that bill, is that there may be some amendments to that bill that will be inclusive of some of what we heard when we was out on the reservations on Friday.
Madam Chair, the amendments that would be provided by the author of the bill would not include those suggestions, amendments, or comments that the minority, or for that member, the public, would have an opportunity to bring forward at the time of the hearing. Given your position on the 24-hour rule, that literally gives us until 2:30 today to make amendments. I'm wondering if there's any latitude on your part that would avail for your willingness to relieve us of the 24-hour rule on amendments in this case. This is, as you said in your own words, this is not a small issue. We have been dealing with this as a body, both in the House and the Senate, for several years. Am I to understand by your comments that this is the only opportunity for this committee to weigh in on this bill is tomorrow?
Yes, Representative Albright. I think we have followed all the protocols and rules that has been in place, and for that reason and purpose, that's the process.
So, Madam Chair, Are you setting precedent for any other bill that comes before this committee? Are you going to stand firm on that regardless of the issue?
Well, I never like to use the word Representative Albright, never and always, because, you know, things can happen that call for some adjustment. But on the stance of the current bill that's coming to this committee tomorrow, there's a 24-hour rule. I believe that we had this 24-hour rule, like, from day one. And so because of that, that's the current stance.
Madam Chair, I think in our rules, even though we are observing consideration of temporary rules right now, the permanent rules suggest that there's a 3-day notification. I understand that in the context of this that you have the discretion to disallow that. How does giving the public 24 hours, legitimately 24 hours rule notice to weigh in on this subject matter fair to the public for testimony tomorrow?
Representative Albright, one of the things that I know about the bill that's coming before this committee is that it's going to travel through this body. This is only the first stop, and as it moves through this body, I'm sure there will be some amendment that will come forth by members in this committee, and as we move through this body, there will be other opportunities for amendments to happen. And thus, I think it will also allow the public to weigh in on those decision-making process.
Madam Chair, by what you've just said, though, this is the only opportunity that this bill will be heard in this committee. And for the people that are on this committee, this will be the only opportunity, if they don't serve on any other committees where this bill will be heard, to weigh in and give consideration to any concerns that their constituents have to that matter. I mean, we're talking about issues that are relevant to a whole host of constituencies. And so as we move forward, I understand that your intention now by your own actions and words are to move forward with deliberation of House File 400 tomorrow. In my opinion, there is no need to rush to this. We have plenty of time. I don't understand the expediency that you wish to put forward. My next question is, will we be taking a vote on the bill to pass it out of committee tomorrow?
Yes, we will, Representative Albright.
And Representative Chair Moran, in light of the minority wanting, and I'm sure this is your concern, not to quash the voice of the minority, would you be willing to postpone the vote on the bill tomorrow and hold it over until next week so we could further vet and fully vet the bill itself and take a vote on it at that time after, candidly, we're dealing with weather outside that really prevents people from venturing down from places where they have just as much of a right to talk to this issue as the metro area? I think you're quashing the opportunity from people from greater Minnesota to come in without threat to their personal lives because of the weather to speak to this issue. And so for the sake of the weather, for the sake of the people that want to talk to this issue, I would ask you again if you would be willing to postpone the vote to move it out of committee so that we have tomorrow as well as time next week to fully vet this before it moves out of this committee for legitimately the last time before it goes to the floor and other committees. Do I have any assurance on your part that you would undertake do that for not only the majority but the minority?
Representative Albright, for as long as I have been in the legislature, for as long as I have been on Health and Human Service committees, I believe it's always been a 24-hour amendment period, always, whether you have been in the majority and minority or whether it has been us. That has been the rule. And so, you know, this opioid bill that's coming to this committee, you know, there's a crisis going out there, going out in the community. And we failed to do this last session. something that could have easily, you know, been taken care of by the majority last session, but did not happen. And so we know the urgency of this bill, the urgency of now. And so for those reasons and all of those reasons, we're going to continue forward with the bill tomorrow. And as the bill travels through this body, the public will have an opportunity for those who cannot come down tomorrow. Unfortunately, you know, in the legislature, we don't postpone hearings. They will have an opportunity to have their voices heard. And more, and I think I want that to happen even more than you. I think that's a very important part of the process.
Madam Chair, then let me conclude by saying that I'm wondering if you would be willing to waive the 24-hour rule on amendments because of the manner in which this bill has come before this committee so quickly, as a show and as a sign of your desire to afford people the opportunity to speak to the issue through amendments or concerns on the bill as it stands before committee tomorrow.
Representative Albright, part of the rules that we have before us is that we have created a two-hour timeline for amendments to amendments. But because I know this is important to you as it is to me, I would waive that to have that two-hour process for amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For tomorrow.
That being said, I appreciate that you're waiving the 24-hour rule. I still have great concerns about the weather. I think we all can speak to that. I know that we have people that would like to come in, but under threat, they are concerned about traveling. And one point, and I just want to clarify and straighten the record out of this body and that majority from the last biennium did pass an opioid bill off the House floor last session. So to your statement about that we could have done something, we did. It stood before the full House. It stood before a number of committees. It stood before this committee on a number of occasions in a number of fashions for more than just an hour and a half. Very, very quickly at the beginning of session, it was fully vetted by both chambers. I just am very concerned that the majority in this case is moving too quickly for the sake of all Minnesota on this bill, which we all recognize is incredibly important to get right. And with that, Madam Majority, I do thank you for your indulgence. We look forward to having a robust debate on that subject tomorrow.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And we do have about 20 testifiers who will be testifying tomorrow. So thank you. All right, so we have a quorum present. So may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
So moved. All right, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. So Representative, motion approved. All right. So we have a Representative Hewitt who's all set and ready to begin. It is called Representative Hewitt Day. in a way, he has three bills before us. I'm sorry, Representative Pearson.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought I was acknowledged and in the queue, and I'm just coming back to this issue. And okay. First of all, I want to. And I'm sure we'll talk about it tomorrow also, the forum that we had in Mille Lacs and all the people that came up and listened to that testimony, you know, that was a lot of information. And I guess I'm you know, as Representative Albright brought up, you know, the inclement weather, the conditions that we're dealing with, and to not acknowledge that there's the potential, even with 20 testifiers lined up, that you're not going to hear from all voices in the state of Minnesota off of this very short notice. And I guess, Madam Chair, my question is, I'm concerned that this is the pattern we're going to see all session, and I just want to establish that we aren't going to just be given a bill. All the language is released at 1:20 in the afternoon on one day, and the next day is when you have to have the amendments submitted. If this is our pattern, or if this is just because it's early in the session and we're really trying to get this rolling through, or is this the type of notice all of the people in the state of Minnesota are going to be dealing with on all issues regarding health and human services policy? Because, again, there are certain people who, you know, they work in our state. They live 4-plus hours away. They need to make plans to take the trip to have their voices heard. And we don't even have the time to turn around and acknowledge and let them know what the actual language of the proposed bill currently is and what state it's in. So I guess I'm very concerned that this is where we're going. And if this is what we're going to be, is playing, I guess I'd call it fast pitch. If we're switching from slow pitch softball to fast pitch softball, where we're going to really need to be on our toes, I'd like you to give us notice of that right now, because this is not fair for outstate Minnesota. It doesn't take us 20 minutes to get to the Capitol. This is outrageous. So I'm curious if this is going to be the pattern. Madam Chair, thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Pearson. You know, our state is important to us, which is why we took our committee hearing out to outstate Minnesota, which that has never been done in the history of this legislature. So we do know the importance of allowing the voices of outstate to be heard. So in response to whether or not this is the pattern, I think next week bills are probably already up so that the public can see that. So if your question to me is whether this will be a pattern, is a tradition that has happened within this body to have a 24-hour deadline, but we have already moved forward past that and have posted bills that you will see next week are already up.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that's why I'm saying, if that's what your goal is, then why can't you honor what Representative Albright has just requested, which is just to extend this. This is just on the one issue, on the one topic, where clearly we didn't meet that pattern. And I feel like it's such an important topic, such an important issue that so many people really want to weigh in on. I just don't understand why we wouldn't honor what Representative Albright had requested.
Yes, Representative Pearson. And again, this is the first stop. This is the very first stop. And others would definitely have an opportunity to chime into the conversation and bring their voices to the table, their concerns around this crisis that are impacting real people's lives and families. We heard about the deaths that have happened out in greater Minnesota. You know, one of the communities that have been impacted in a huge way has been the reservations. You know, that's important to us. And we're going to address it. We're going to address it in a good, timely manner and create a process and a place where people can come forth to share not only the problems of it, but so that we can have a solution. This bill is just a beginning, you know, and, you know, in a lot of ways, what you see today may not be what you see at the end, because we're open enough to hear those voices and do what we need to do to amend that bill as it moves so that we can have a great impact on the outcomes of people's lives. So, again, this is the first stop for this bill. It has other stops that it would make where I'm sure we would create a process so that folks will have enough time to come and travel, whether it's 4 hours, whether it is 6 hours, that they will be able to have a chance to have their voices if they choose to.
Well, Madam Chair, it isn't the first stop. It's the first stop for the bill, but it's the last stop in health and human services policy.
I agree.
And my concern there is just with the information we received on Friday at that hearing, the change in trajectory of what even the tribal community was requesting or not requesting from the state of Minnesota in that meeting, the changes alone from that testimony, to me, it was eye-opening. And so tomorrow, just a few days later, we're supposed to have put out all of the information and gotten more feedback from people, and with 24.5 hours of information with the actual bill, we're supposed to turn around and have all of our testifiers back in here. Again, I just don't understand why the request by Representative Albright can't be accepted. It's the last stop for public, for our policy, Health and Human Services policy. So I just think it's dismissive to say, hey, you know, that it's all right. It's going to be going through a lot of other committees, and that's great, because from now on moving forward, we'll have a memo from the chair of Ways and Means that will tell us where it's going. And depending on that designation, the public may have, again, less than or just over 24 hours of notice on where that's going to land. And I've had meetings today where people are in my office. They don't know where bills are going to be traveling. They don't know who they should be talking to in this room. They don't know, am I going to need to go through Health and Human Services policy with my bill? They're worried about that with all of the committee process at this point. So the question becomes, without that notice, without us getting informed, without people having their 15-minute meetings with us to educate us on the issues, you know, how are we going to move forward with this? And again, you're assuring me all the bills for next week are already up. That's great news. That's what we need. That's wonderful news. But Representative Albright on this extremely important issue is asking for just not having a vote tomorrow on it. It's not going to be taken up on the House floor on Monday, is it? It's going to be going through a few more committee stops. I don't understand why we have to be resistant to that idea. It's our last stop.
Representative Pearson and Albright, some of this is beyond the scope of this committee right here. I don't want to go in circles. I don't want to keep repeating myself. I don't want, you know, you continue to ask me the same questions over and over. You know, we have people who have traveled here today for this hearing. We need to be respectful to them and allow them to also have a voice on the bills that have come before this committee. And I do have other people on the list, and I'm thinking we may speak to this conversation here. But I would like to get to that testifier and allow the people who traveled here today to also have a place to have their voices heard. That is important, too. And so what I'm going to do,
Madam Chair, if I could just maybe conclude then with just two brief questions, and these you know the answers to, so they'll be brief. The first one is, for the committee hearing tomorrow, are you aware of any other amendments that have already been authored besides those by the author?
No, sir.
And if you could, then, not detail, but if this were this bill, which will likely go to Commerce, which will likely go to any number of other committees, will amendments offered in those committees that would be relatable back to health policy, will they be deemed germane in that committee?
I have no president over any other committee besides this one.
Madam Chair, that is why both Representative Pearson and I have raised the questions relevant to this, and I will conclude by saying I think that we are the majority is establishing a very dangerous precedent by the handling of this very important issue. Thank you.
So to the testifier, can you please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. One moment. So the chair moves that Representative Hewitt Bills, House File 147, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. So Representative Hewitt, welcome to the committee, and testifiers, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a lighter note, I did the freshman thing here, even gluten-free.
Calorie-free?
Sorry. Sorry, Representative, Madam Chair. House File 147 is a telehealth bill for community paramedics and community EMTs. This will answer to providers who can utilize telehealth services. The use of telehealth continues to grow, and these providers are working today in the field of communicating with other medical providers. With me today is Peter Carlson from the Mayo Clinic Medical Transportation. Peter is a community paramedic coordinator for Mayo. And also with me is Dr. Peter Tangi. I should have used the card. From North Memorial Healthcare to testify on this bill. Madam Chair, that she has to recognize you.
I'm sorry. Please introduce yourself.
All right, Madam Chair, thank you. Members, good afternoon. My name is Peter Carlson, as was shared. And I'm the community paramedic coordinator for Mayo Clinic Medical Transport. So I'm here today testifying as a community paramedic in support of House File 147. Yep. And I'll let Dr. Tangi introduce himself.
And my name is Pete Tangi. I'm an emergency medicine physician and board certified in EMS as well. My primary role right now is as a medical director of a community paramedic program at North Memorial. And I'm here to testify in support of HF 147.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, so I've been working now in EMS for about 15 years, had an opportunity to be fortunate enough to work in both rural and urban environments, and for the last 6 years been working and functioning as a community paramedic. And so we see it as a natural progression and the services that we deliver to our communities to be able to also augment some of our restrictions or our constraints in the form of dashboard time and being able to leverage telehealth and two-way video audio. So I think it's with the work that we've really done that's rooted in primary care in our systems that is related to the care plans that have been built for the patients that we're seeing, that we see an opportunity to still be in the home consistently and regularly, but also be able to do some of our supplemental visits via video audio, extending the primary care provider and their kind of interdisciplinary teams. Expertise into the community at times can be difficult. It's seen as an administrative burden even for some of our systems to kind of find time for a lot of the what we consider smaller things to make a care plan come to reality, but we're in large support of the community paramedic being able to initiate care in the form of an in-home face-to-face intake and from that point be able to assure compliance to the care plan and subsequent visits in the form of video and audio. So I'll hand it over to Dr. Tangi.
Continue, please.
And what our program has watched how telemedicine has allowed us to really expand our reach and augment the services that we're providing to people. So to me, I really see this as a yet another way to improve access to care. And pick your barrier, there's a way that the telemedicine helps overcome it, whether it's the weather, whether it's a transportation issue because your vehicle's not working, whether it's because you're too sick or you broke your ankle and that's why you need some assistance. So we have a number of other reasons and examples that highlight that, but to me, it as we use this and see how it transforms our work and the lives of the people that we're serving, it's really just a no-brainer on the benefit of allowing a community paramedic, community EMT to work with the technology of telehealth.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I believe the department's here and also wants to speak on it.
Okay, do we have other testifiers? All right, please introduce yourself and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tony Spector, and I'm the Executive Director of the State Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. I appear before you regarding House File 147 to express the concerns of the board regarding the proposal to allow community paramedics and community EMTs to perform telemedicine services. Excuse me. These concerns are held by the emergency physicians on our board, pardon me, who serve as ambulance service medical directors, including the medical director of an ambulance service with the community paramedic program. Likewise, these concerns are held by our board vice chair, who also serves as the EMSRB legislative chair of that committee. He also serves as the deputy chief of operations of a large ambulance service with the community paramedic program. The community paramedicine program is an effective tool for healthcare organizations looking for community-based strategies to reduce hospital readmissions. They help people get on top of their chronic disease processes so they are not getting so sick that they need to visit an emergency department. Likewise, community paramedicine serves as a part of integrated healthcare, particularly as it relates to post-discharge care, endeavoring to reduce the likelihood of readmission for the same or similar issue. Now, a hallmark of community paramedicine is the in-home visit. Essentially, it is the primary care provider's off-site eyes and ears, which become part of the patient's care plan. In that visit, community paramedicine conducts a site inspection. Is the home environment safe? Are there slips or trips and fall issues? Does it appear that the patient is in an environment where he or she can engage in self-care? Does the patient understand his or her medication regimen? What is the patient's blood pressure? What is the patient's heart rate? What is the patient's oxygen saturation? What is the patient's mental state? Is it altered? And how is the patient with wound care? Do sutures need to be removed? Again, a key component to the community paramedicine program is the home visit, meeting with the patient, the house call. Now, I wish to quote one of our board emergency physicians whose ambulance service has a respected community paramedicine program, and I quote, "It takes a lot of experience and a certain amount of willingness to accept liability to provide medical care without actually having direct in-the-room conversation and an examination of the patient. As an EMS MD, I think it unwise." Now, for quite some time in Minnesota, community paramedicine has been about the community paramedic. In Minnesota, there's now a new addition to that paradigm. It is the community EMT. I wish to speak specifically about the community EMT. This is a brand new certification level with an education program that was pilot tested last year by one of the local technical colleges. The result of that pilot project is that we have 10 community EMTs currently certified by my state agency. We have no metrics on the program's success. We have no metrics on the education program success. We have no metrics on the student's success. To be an EMT in Minnesota, it requires successfully completing a 150-plus-hour course. That's it. It does not require a degree, 150-plus hours. Now, the community EMT pilot program is an education course that's about 50 hours of combined classroom, clinical simulation, and hands-on patient contact. And the very education model presented to the EMSRB earlier this year for approval includes absolutely nothing about telemedicine. Referring back to that emergency physician whose ambulance service has a community paramedicine program, he wrote, and I quote, "EMTs have very little medical training to begin with, and the majority of it focuses on emergencies and not chronic health or post-hospitalization checkups. Allowing them to do anything more than make an in-home social visit and check some vital signs in this patient population is really pushing their abilities. I view my duty as an EMS physician to be the line in the sand and to stick up for patient safety, and this one concerns me." Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, good day to you. You noted some fairly intriguing comments. This is a brand new configuration. I'm sorry, did I get the wrong? I'm sorry.
Mr. Spector.
Mr. Spector, I'm sorry. First, you mentioned this is a brand new certification.
Yes.
You also referenced that there's no metrics for success on this.
Correct.
in health policy, oftentimes we deal with scope of practice and the policy of making sure that people stay within their lanes. My daughter is a paramedic of some years, and we talk about this career path very, very frequently in terms of the situational awareness that she has to come into and whether or not she is adept and capable of taking care of that. What assurance can this bill provide to the public that community emergency medical technicians are going to stay within, in their lane, Madam Chair?
Mr. Spector.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I'm not certain that the bill has any of those assurances in its current language.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Hewitt, how would you respond to that same question in light of your background and what your bill asserts to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it's a great question. As you know, if your daughter's a paramedic, she stays in her lane. Great analogy. We have a scope that we have to stay within. The bill does not go into the scope. It's in the statute already. That tells me what lane I have to stay in when I'm working with a patient. What I do is because I have a medical director that's signing off on everything I do, and if I go beyond that, my license gets taken by you. So, as you know, your daughter has to follow her lane, and that would be the same principle I would follow in a community EMT program doing telemedicine. So it's in there. We know it. We don't go outside that lane. If we do, we're not practicing what our scope is.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Hewitt. So you're suggesting that the statute already in the books represents the safeguards that you are willing to accept for a program that is brand new, for metrics that have not been proven on this other than in the pilot program. So we're relying upon what's already on the books without verification. It's kind of a trust but verify. So would you agree or disagree that we should maybe roll it out in a different venue, or we're just going to put the public at risk?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright.
Representative Hewitt.
Definitely not put the public at risk. And I don't feel that this has not been tested. It's been tested by community paramedics already. And so I feel that I understand the department's concern about this. I get it. But we're already in a space right now where we're seeing this in the community paramedicine venue. Now, does the bill need work? It does. And I think as we go through the process here, we're willing to accept amendments to it and clean it up quite a bit. But we wanted to get it out there. And that's where we're at, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you so much. But Mr. Hewitt, to your point with this bill specifically, Representative Pearson and I just completed a conversation with the chair about rushing things through. This is the only stop for this bill in this committee. And you, by your own words, suggest that this bill has work to do. But yet, this is the only time that we get to see this bill in this committee that is germane to our section of the code that we have purview over. Do you understand? Maybe I might suggest to you, maybe you should suggest to the chair that we hold this over, lay it on the table, let's amend it here, rather than worry about if it's amendable and germane in another committee. The process, the pragmatic process, nature of the process, is fundamental to getting it right the first time. Do you know what step or what committee this bill will be heard in next?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, interesting you should ask. There are people from all over the state in this room today that I've met with the last 3 days that have seen this bill over the last 2 weeks. They've been giving me input, and we're going at it. So I do feel that the new system is working for this. Being a freshman now, I might not have the same experience you do, but it is working. And so I do feel that, yes, maybe there's another technique we can use here on this bill because it hasn't been here before, and we do got to fix it up a little bit. But I think we can move forward with this. I really do. I think now's the time, and I don't know which committee you'll refer to. I don't know where it'll go from here. I have an opinion, but I'm stuck with that. So the bottom line is I think we should move it forward, and we can amend it along the way, Madam Chair.
Motion has been that it be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Alford.
Representative Hewitt, you referenced in the beginning of your response to me that you have had consideration by a number of people in this room and that they have offered to you comments or criticisms, if you will, positive ones on this bill. Where are the amendments that we should affix to this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I believe there is an amendment on this bill, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, I have that bill. I have that amendment. I'm offering it. Where are the people that you have consulted with? Where are their amendments if you suggest that they want to provide criticism and changes to the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we've talked to them, and we're ready to work with them on it as the bill progresses.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright, I'll give you one closing last statement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, this is a bill that is not ready for prime time. I appreciate your sentiment, and I'm not asking these questions just because you're a freshman carrying an important piece of legislation. But there are others that I have talked with that have very serious concerns about this bill that would respectfully request that it be laid over and held over, excuse me, for work in this committee. I cannot stress enough the import of making sure that this committee does the proper vetting, the proper due diligence on the bills that we are responsible to. And I think it is a disservice to this committee and everyone in here that has an election certificate to not allow them the opportunity to speak from either their constituency or from their profession to this bill or others that has a direct bearing on a profession that is the front line for taking care of those that are in most need amongst us.
Representative Hewitt, if you want to respond to his request.
Madam Chair, we're going to lay the bill over.
Madam Chair, I think the proper motion would be to lay it on the table.
Representative Albright, Representative Hewitt, I'm going to delay the bill and lay it over into further notice. Thank you. All right, so let's move on to House File 148. Thank you. The chair moves that Representative Hewitt bill, House File 148, be recommended to be placed on the general register. We have the bill before us. Representative Hewitt, would you please present your bill?
Madam Chair, House members, House File 148. This bill is purpose of legislation would be to add basic life support ambulance services to the community EMT statute. The initial legislation allowed emergency medical technicians that were part of a medical response to become community EMTs. The proposal clarifies and adds basic life support ambulance services to train staff as community EMTs also. Mr. McAlpine from the Minnesota Ambulance Service is here to testify on this.
Okay, please introduce yourself and...
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. This was brought to our legislative committee by mostly our rural members probably 3 years ago now when we first did the community EMT statute. We stuck it into the piece of 144E statute that was a medical responder unit, so more of the fire services sitting in the room today and behind me that were using this in the metro. And our goal always behind community paramedic and community EMT was an outstate focus. And about 60% of our rural ambulances are still what's called basic life support volunteer ambulances. And we've heard from some of the rural hospital-based ones, Warren, Minnesota, some like that, that they would like to start to be able to train and utilize their EMTs, their paid in this community EMT role. So they're allowed to charge for services under our Medicaid statute that we enabled a couple years ago to pay for CEMT services. So what this does is add the word basic life support ambulance and change the definition from community medical response medical response emergency medical technician to community emergency medical technician, which has been the acronym we've used over the last few years over CEMT.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Okay, to the next testifier, Laura Sales.
Okay.
Is there any other one who would like to speak to the bill? Members? Okay, hearing none. The chair renews her motion that House File 148 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevail. House File 148 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you. So let's move on to House File 189. Representative Hewitt, would you please introduce? The chair moves that Representative Hewitt bill, House File 189, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. If you have, we have the bill before us. Representative Hewitt, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 189. The purpose of this legislation is to request an increase the Medicare rate for ambulance services 5% in the metro area in the communities of St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth, Rochester. In 2016, the legislative session in the legislature increased the ambulance service rate 5% for ambulance service located in rural communities. This request would equalize the ambulance rate statewide. Again, Mr. McAlpine is here from the Ambulance Association to answer questions.
Mr. Alpine, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpine, Minnesota Ambulance Association. Representative Hewitt's right. A few years ago, we did the rural part of the state. We worked with the House and Senate finance chairs to come up with some funding to be able to get some more money out to the rural areas, especially. If you look at the Medicare and Medicaid payer mix, it can run as high as 80% in some of our rural ambulance services, and we just wanted to do something with the rates. Working with our partners at DHS, it's been a little complicated. If you look at those communities Representative Hewitt just mentioned, our partners like Alina or Gold Cross Ambulance, the Mayo Ambulance, and North Memorial, some of the outstate operations and our air medical folks haven't been able to take advantage of some of that rate increase, although they're out in the rural areas because of where their base of operations located. So this would be a way that we would like to stabilize the rate increase statewide. So the one from a few years ago would be a 5% level for everybody.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Members, do you have any questions? Representative Backer.
Yes. Madam Chair, I would just would ask the author that as this goes through the finance that we would communicate, because I was the author of the to increase the 5%, because 76% to 80% of our runs are public assistance. So it's very difficult. We don't have that private mix to keep things going. Like in my service, my wife and I, along with the service, we sent out letters this year. We raised $23,000 so we can keep our ambulance in Browns Valley open. The year before, we did sing letter. We have to do that. So I would just ask the author, I know where you're coming from, I appreciate where that, but as with moves, I know this is policy and not finance, but this is my opportunity, because I don't sit on finance, that maybe we can work together and do a 5% bump on everything. So that's what I would want to share with the author there.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from members? All right, hearing none. The chair renews her motion that House File 189 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion prevails. House File 189 is recommended to be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It would be good to ask for the dissenting votes as well, just in case.
there's dissenting views and dissenting votes over surpass the affirmation vote of ayes, but you should request that.
All right, thank you. I will.
As in you should ask for that forward. Now if there are any dissenting votes.
Is there any dissenting votes? Thank you for that. I'm still learning this new thing here. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. All right, I appreciate it. Thank you. So, all right, so I want to bring up my next testifier. New author on House File 99, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiberg, would you like to move your bill?
Sure. I'd like to move that House File 99 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. We have the bill before us. Representative Freiberg, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This proposed legislation was heard last session and funded in the 2018 vetoed budget bill. It would provide up to $1 million in grant funding to community paramedic programs who work on reducing opioid deaths. An ambulance service that received a grant under this proposal shall develop and implement a program in which community paramedics connect with patients discharged from a hospital or emergency department following an opioid overdose. With me to testify is Peter Carlson from the Mayo Clinic Medical Transport. Peter is the community paramedic coordinator for Mayo.
Mr. Carlson, please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Carlson. As mentioned, I work with Mayo Clinic Medical Transport as a community paramedic coordinator, and here's a community paramedic to support House File 99. And I think that the work community paramedics have done in our communities over the last 6 years is a testimony, and again, to kind of differentiate or delineate between community EMT and community paramedic, I'm referring to community paramedic. We've done very strong work as far as reduction in total cost of care through means of improving outcomes as a result of decreasing kind of acute care utilization. So really our work is focused on improving and increasing primary care access, which we feel like we're able to transfer that skill set into the population that's also dealing with addiction very well, and to assure that we're able to get into the community post naloxone or Narcan administration in all of our emergent calls, to then follow up upon hospital discharge or ER discharge, emergency room, to do an in-home assessment and a set of other tests that you can see outlined in the bill as an opportunity to link our populations to a more robust primary care relationship and to assure that care plans are both created and adhered to. So open for questions, and thank you for letting me be here.
All right, thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes back to the House File
147.
And I'll just refer for the interest of the author. On line 1.18, we reference community paramedic team. And in the context of the conversation that I'm sure you heard with regard to House File 147, where's the assurance of staying in your lane as you and I, Representative, have over the last several years recognized that most people that are suffering from an opioid type of addiction or substance addiction typically have co-occurring, you know, symptoms or problems. So even more to the point of how do we assure that community paramedics stay in their lane and aren't practicing other professional disciplines? How do we assure the public that they're going to stay in their lane?
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I have not heard any concerns about that. I did ask, I don't have the expertise in paramedics that that yourself or Representative Hewitt have. I have not heard from any groups that are concerned with that. I did ask the advocates for this bill if that would be an issue. They said it's part of what ambulance providers regularly do. He's here, can provide more information if you know, as I said, I haven't heard any concerns. I don't see a rush on this if there are still concerns about that point, but I have none have been brought to me at this point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hall.
Representative Freiberg, I don't see on here, but I'm just wondering, and you referenced, you know, constituent groups that probably, you know, weighed in on this, but I'm wondering if in the interest of, you know, NAMI or other organizations that would have a very concerted issue with this, I'm just wondering if they had been consulted and if they have a concern or if they are neutral in favor of this bill. And I'm wondering, I have a couple of follow-ups, and I'm not trying to belabor it. I just am very concerned about the responsibility that we're laying on people who may not have the professional acumen that other disciplines have. So I hope you'll indulge me.
Representative Carson, anything? No.
Okay,
Representative Freiberg.
Sure. Yeah, actually, both. I've had a couple people who've requested to speak on this, if it could be turned over to them.
Please.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, Madam
Please
Chair.
Please state your name.
Representative Ahlberg. Still Pete. So I think Peter Carlson. So to touch on the question, the concern, I am glad you're bringing it up, and I think the consistent request on this lane is intriguing. The community paramedic work that's been underway for 6 years and following kind of the rules and guidelines of the statute has been largely successful in a series of disease processes. So really what we're doing is replicating that process. And this is about compliance and primary care introduction, things that can be done very easily if we take the time to use the data in front of us to assure that there's some type of follow-up, mm-hmm. which is not taking place today within the population. So it's not a question of ability or recognizing lane at all for us. But if you could be more specific with some examples, it'd be helpful for a more thorough response.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll use the example in past sessions where a welfare check by law enforcement has also included someone from the mental health profession discipline, because rather than go in and not be aware of situationally aware of what might be happening with the individual inside the room or inside the house, that there is a person that is trained for, in that case, possibly some de-escalation of the event. If someone walks in and they're not prepared for the call, but yet they think there's something else going on, I'm just wondering, in the context of a community paramedic, if that type of a situation has been addressed, and how would you address it from a perspective of putting those community health paramedics at risk for what they might be walking into in a situation where they believe something to be happening, but a different situation might present itself to them very, very quickly with life on the line.
So, okay, Mr. Carson.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. Phenomenal question. I appreciate the context, and I think it's that's helpful to really be able to label a scenario and specific to that, but also broad to our discipline. There's a lot of education that's consistently provided as a part of our certification in order to have the level of situational awareness, and in our case, the verbal de-escalation, in addition to the motivational interviewing skill sets. When you bring up NAMI and other organizations, we are a referral professional. I think if I was given one floor in an elevator to explain to any of you what we do as community paramedics, it would be we create a network around the patient. And so there's no shortage of referral from us to any other body, be it home health nursing, NAMI, or any other entity that's needed in the care provision. The steering of that care plan is still being done by our APPs, or our advanced practice practitioners, and our physicians that are working in the primary care system. Specific to this bill, it's an opportunity where the data has not been able to show us a consistent relationship with primary care, and I think that's really the impetus for asking and supporting this bill, is that we want to help to create that bridge over to the system.
Madam Chair, if I could just ask one more question.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm actually going to ask Mr. Spector to come down, only for just to provide a diversity of opinion on this, and to see whether or not his opinion or his position might be any different from what I've already heard.
Thank you, sir. Madam Chair.
Okay, please introduce yourself and respond. You would need to be at the table to as a testifier. So why don't, you know, we'll open it up to more testifiers in a minute, okay? All right, thank you. Please reintroduce yourself and
thank you. Tony Spector, Executive Director of EMS Regulatory Board. Representative, sir, could you restate the question for me, please?
So would your board have a favorable opinion of the expansion of this or not? Are there criticism or critiques that you would provide? I will add to my question in terms of some of these instances require translation into other languages. How do you address that?
Madam Chair, Representatives,
yes,
thank you.
Please.
Mr.
Spector, go ahead. Proceed.
Oh, thank you. This topic has not come before the board members, so this has not been brought before our board. So I believe it would be premature for me to speak as to the board's position on a policy matter that has been brought before it. What I can say is that you identified real-world situations, real-world concerns that hopefully a community paramedic program, if it was going into the field for post-discharge follow-up, follow-through aftercare as it relates to a naloxone overdose, it would be incumbent upon that program to ensure that the community paramedics are well-trained in that that mental health. I mean, it covers a panoply of matters. It would be incumbent for success to be very well trained and focused in that. But again, to be clear, this has not been a matter that's been brought before the MSRB board. So, I'd be premature for me to speak of policy.
Representative Edison.
I think Mr. Albright's going to take all the time. All right. So in terms of looking at this, I think I have just a few questions for people at home or for people here. Can you just really explain the timeline of what something like this would look like from pickup, from where you first have contact with the person that's experiencing the overdose to the very end of what this looks like? And I have a follow-up as well.
Representative, is it Carson or Spector?
Yeah, just Peter Carlson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Mr. Carson.
Representative. Okay. I kind of like it. It sounds nice. Makes my mother proud. So, great question. Probably should have walked through that. I apologize ahead of time. But we've got a substantial amount of data from programs throughout the state that are showing the ability to get in the home in as early as 3 days, which may sound like a stretch of time, but it's actually quite successful when compared to a lot of other interventions. So if one were to overdose and be in the need of naloxone, they could have a provider in their home in the form of community paramedic in as little as, you know, 24 hours and in as long as what we're finding is an average of 3 days. So there are some constraints and variables that make it more difficult with the population that we're promoting and really excited to have the opportunity to work more closely with. And so we've got the infrastructure in place to be able to, through what are referred to as best practice alerts, alert our systems that we've created this interoperability or communication between so that we can deploy the resource. And so initially it's telephone outreach, but it's also introduction of the program. And so if you overdose, have the antagonist or naloxone to reverse your opiate overdose, you may be meeting your community paramedic while still in the hospital, in the emergency department, or on the floor if you required a admission for your event. So hopefully that helps, but it's a tight window, and there's communication on the front and the back because we see this representing almost a small fire, if you will, in terms of there's a lot of risk that there's going to be a recurrence of this episode. And so if we see it on the front end as paramedics, we're able to refer a rebound resource into that person's life. That can happen within just a couple of days and be instantly connected and communicating with that primary care team through the electronic health record.
Representative Alderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so on looking on the back, it says work with you're looking with a team of physical and mental health professionals. As somebody that has been a mental health therapist, I wonder how much training just in terms of looking at like addiction and mental health, the paramedics are getting, and how are they working with those other professionals to make sure that the person who is coming out of addiction is well taken care of?
Mr. Carson.
And I would hand that, if okay with you, to Dr. Tangi. I think he can speak to the...
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Introduce yourself and then proceed.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Pete Tangi. I'm board certified in emergency medicine and emergency medical services. I work with a community paramedic program in the metro area, and I've been involved with some rural community paramedic programs as well. To answer your question, Representative, the training would be tailored to the population that we would be serving and who we would be working with. And I think part of the key language in all of what we're talking about is the community paramedic team, which allows us to participate in whatever resources we've identified through our needs assessment. So for my community paramedics in my system, it might be working with our specific addiction counselors and our clinic and following an education plan and a prescription, a care plan that they help us craft and educate us to. Our basic knowledge of community paramedicine is in sort of the chronic disease management and, like Mr. Carlson mentioned, the motivational interviewing and some basic tenets of just helping people improve their health. If it's another system that might be up, you know, in Two Harbors, Minnesota, that resources that are available there are going to be different, and that's going to be reflected in the education, training, and referral pattern of a program that might exist there. So I think really to highlight what we're looking for is, and what we've done historically, is identified the needs of a community and a population, and then designed, and then taken that a step further to an individual and designed a care plan that works for them. And the community paramedics then have the initial education to do that, and then it's a continual learning process as well. That we go up, quite frankly, that we're learning with patients, with people. So it's understanding it. Why are you using the drug this way? Why hasn't the previous treatment worked for you? We're going to help you get to the right place. So
I would like to bring to the members' attention that we have DHS here, and we was wanted to, you know, allow them to complete their presentation from last week. We have a few members who would like to speak. Becker, Fisher, Becker, Fisher, and Mann. And so if we can try to do this more quickly than not, that would be great. So, Becker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is obviously, run through this process. You get called to a scene, overdose, and then obviously go to ER. And then what process does your community, EMTs, in your situation, you know, doctor, what process do you do to identify those needs that will work with that person? Because like Representative Albright, you know, my concern is are we going to be doing other things instead of what this grant is for? So how do I identify those needs and stay on task? And what would it... Like you got called, I was OD'd on OD, opio, and so forth. Some parameters you're thinking about in this program, because this is a very generic, because this is very general, but we want to help the people, you know, that are having those challenges. Can you give me a little oversight on that, please?
Who would like to take that?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Reintroduce yourself.
Just the I'm looking for the practical. Sure. I'm an EMT. I want to know the practical part.
That's great. Yeah. So Peter Carlson, and Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz.
No, close.
Baker.
Backer.
My apologies. I didn't do my homework.
Right.
All right. So another great question. I think to me it doesn't read as generic or broad as your interpretation, but the data for Mayo Medical Clinic transport that we looked at reveals a pretty large opportunity in the Narcan administration. We don't go 24 hours without administering it, and it's 55% of that is focused at two of our 12 sites in the state of Minnesota. So we see it as an opportunity to be quite specific in the application, the buildup of the resources needed as outlined in this grant to follow up
in the home and actually be able to do the evaluation of prescription medications, do the medication reconciliation, refer to medication therapy management pharmacist as needed, do an HIV risk assessment, go through Narcan instructions, a basic needs assessment, all of this being done under the auspice of team-based care. And so we can bring it back to an integrated behavioral health atmosphere where I'm at, and you know, link the right, whether it's psychotherapy or other resources, into the intervention. So I think that we will have, there's plenty of work to do in this space, and so that's definitely not a concern on our end. And it'll be, it's very specific if Narcan is administered, and that brings us closer to our first responders, our police and fire as well, because we create channels of communication with the other entities that are administering Narcan in our communities. That will be the patient demographic or inclusion criteria that we use to perform this follow-up.
Thank you. No follow-up.
So this is what we're going to do. In the interest of time, we're going to lay this bill over until further notice. But if you guys have any questions that you would like to ask of the testifiers in the meantime, please do so. And so we're going to lay this over, and we're going to bring over the department to start their presentation. So thank you so much, and we will contact you as to the next hearing. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody can just imagine. It's thrilling. Do they have it in their packets?
So while they're working on the technical piece of this, why don't we get started? Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair. Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claire Wilson. Again, I am the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services, and we are so grateful to get a little time just to finish our overview.
Share with us what slide we were on.
Sure. I believe we were on slide 50. So if you have that in your packets, I don't think it needs to be projected.
Your save package.
This is the Community Supports Administration. So again, this is just to familiarize you with the way in which the department is organized, and so that you can see who is responsible for which divisions. And so I'll just move through this fairly quickly. And of course, welcome questions, but also want to assure that we leave some time for Assistant Commissioner Farrago to talk about the Children and Family Services Division. So Community Supports is the division within the department that contains the Behavioral Health Division, the Disability Services Division, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division, and the Housing and Support Services. It's most of the policy areas within the agency. And again, as I mentioned during the overview last week, these divisions within each division are somewhat false silos, because we are all serving the same populations. And we did make a move this year to integrate our Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division and our Mental Health Division into one Behavioral Health Division to assure that we were really accounting for the whole health of the individuals that we're serving. We also have a new team within this division called the Community Care Integration Reform division. And this division is really tasked at how we can really focus on systems-wide reform that benefit all of our populations. And that division sits right between the healthcare administration and the policy administration so that we can assure that we are leveraging all of our arms to tackle systems reform. So we serve children and adults with behavioral health issues. We serve people living with disabilities. We serve deaf and hard of hearing Minnesotans. And we serve seniors and adults with disabilities who have low income and, of course, housing instability. What we do is really oversee these systems. So we work on our long-term services and supports system. We train, develop capacity for providers who operate within each of these service continuums. We continue to support research to assure that we are following evidence-based practices and encouraging that from our providers. And we also provide direct services. So now we are on slide number 53. And I will say that the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division is the only division within this administration that actually provides direct services. We have regional offices across the state, and would encourage you all to interact with the division. So there we are. That's what we do. And there you can see the illustration of the fact that one in five Minnesotans face a mental illness each year. So I'll just quickly go through. The Disability Services Division is the largest division within this administration. And, you know, it includes the four disability waivers. It includes our state plan services, so PCA and home health care. This is where we operate the Disability Hub, which, again, I hope that you will encourage your constituents to utilize the Disability Hub. It has a wealth of resources and information. And then recently launched Direct Support Connect, which connects direct support workers with people looking for services. It's an exciting new service. And then, of course, we have been leading in that division the Waiver Reimagined Project, which is helping us think about how to streamline our waivered services. So there's a lot of exciting work going on in that division. The next division is the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. That is our smallest division, but small but mighty. And as I said, they have regional offices. They operate the TED program. They support interpreters in greater Minnesota. And they are serving both our deaf population and our growing hard of hearing population as our population ages. The next division is the Behavioral Health Division. As I said, this is a new division. It is now integrated with the former Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division and the Mental Health Division. This is where we are implementing the SUD reform. It's where we're working on our mental health policy. It is where we are administering our grant programs, so SchoolLink Mental Health, crisis grants. Well, there'll be a lot of discussion around all of those programs this session. And then the Housing and Support Services Division, and this is where we are operating our income assistance and housing support services. So just a reminder, and we talked about this at length at the last hearing, but the area in which we are seeing the greatest growth, both in spending and in services, is in our elderly and people with disabilities populations. And, you know, we need to continue and are continuing to look at ways to leverage natural supports, to leverage technology, to work on streamlining services, and look at different ways that we can control that growth without limiting access to much-needed services. And finally, as we've been stressing the workforce crisis again, and especially in our, as we were noting earlier, in our mental health professional environment, we all of Minnesota is basically a mental health professional shortage area. And so we know that really not having those providers leads to lack of access to critical services. So just as we are working to address the direct care workforce, we're hoping to continue to look at the mental health workforce shortage and address that. And that is community supports in just under 4 minutes.
That is awesome. Thank you. So, Representative Pearson.
Just on the last slide, you have the not designated and designated. What do you mean by designated? That's just been designated as a workforce shortage area? Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. So the only two, I should have said the only two areas that are not designated are the metro and the southeast corner.
Representative Pearson.
So, I mean, I'm in the southeast corner, corridor, or whatever you want to, and all I hear about is the shortages we have. So how are we not designated as an area of shortage when I anecdotally hear it all the time?
Assistant Commissioner Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson. So these numbers actually come from the Department of Health and their rural office, so we could touch back with them, but they help designate based on the number of providers. I think it's a ratio of providers to service areas. So we'll get back to you with why that might be.
And again, I'm sorry, we're both the metro and the southeast corner of our state are, you know, they're kind of hubs for where people get care. And so just because the provider number is high, that doesn't necessarily mean the ratio is appropriate for the area. And so I'd really like to get a follow-up on that, because that seems like a, you know, it's if the quota is simply providers per population, that's exactly the reason that we have higher costs in southeast Minnesota on health care across the board, because people come to these areas, they come to the Twin Cities, they come to Mayo Clinic, of course, to seek care, and that to me seems like it'd be the same factor here.
Assistant Commissioner Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will follow up. And you know, just to say whether it's designated or not, we know anecdotally that all areas are suffering from a lack of access to providers and workers.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? In that case?
No, we're not done.
You're not done?
No.
Oh, okay. Please introduce yourself and continue. We have 5 minutes.
Okay.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Nikki Farrago. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at DHS. So I am just going to take a few minutes just to highlight what programs are in the Children and Family Services area. So we have 4 programmatic divisions. Our Child Safety and Permanency Division includes our child protection system. So that includes our prevention services as well as foster care and our permanent placements, including adoptions. We also have our Child Support Division, our Child Care Services, which includes our Child Care Assistance Program, as well as our Child Development Services, including our quality rating system, known as Parent Aware. We also have our Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division. That includes our Minnesota Family Investment Program, known as MFIP, our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for our food support program, known as SNAP, as well as our Refugee Resettlement Program. That's a federally funded program, and our Office of Economic Opportunity that works with our community action partners. So in Children and Family Services, we have a wide variety of programs, and we serve many different demographics across the state. We serve low-wage workers and their children. We serve people that need food assistance across the state, including children, people with disabilities, and the elderly. We serve families and children that are served by the child welfare system, families and children that are in need of child support services and child care assistance services, as well as refugees. So there's a chart on the right of the slide just to show you a snapshot of poverty in Minnesota. And what you'll see is that children are most at risk of being and living in poverty in Minnesota, and young children especially. I think that's especially noteworthy when you think about our programs. For instance, we serve approximately 88,000 people through our Minnesota Family Investment Program each month. 72% of the people that we serve on that program are children. And I think I'm just going to highlight a couple other things. So in child care assistance, we serve about 29,000 children in an average month. And on our food support SNAP program, we serve over 400,000 Minnesotans every month. We work with counties and tribes and our community partners in a variety of ways, including child welfare training with our counties and tribes. We work in child support to locate parents, establish parentage, and to enforce our child support obligations that are established. And we also supervise county administration of our cash and food assistance programs and provide guidance and training for those programs across the counties.
Oh, I don't know when away.
Okay. So, so looking a little bit at our forecast programs first. So our spending last year, we had $568 million for our forecasted programs. That includes our Minnesota Family Investment Program, our MFIP Child Care Assistance Program, and our North Star Care for Children, which is our program that provides financial benefits and supports to children that are in foster care placement and in permanent placement. Our other grants and administration makes up about $874 million in spending. About $200 million of that is state funds. And some of our largest programs included in that category are the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The vast majority of, about 99.9%, is federal funding. Our basic sliding fee child care, and then our employment services and supports for adults on both the Minnesota Family Investment Program and SNAP. And I wanted to highlight, but I'm gonna skip over these, but I wanted to highlight some issues that we encounter when we're administering our programs in several of our programs, such as child care, the MFIP grant, and child welfare. I think what's most salient across all of our programs and for the department as a whole is that we see disproportionality and we see disparities in the outcomes of the people that we serve. So regardless of a program, as Deputy Commissioner Wilson stated, we're serving the same families. And we know that we have a lot of work to do, but we are committed to doing that work. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Assistant Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, for your presentation and being so expedient in getting it done. I'm just sorry that we didn't have a longer time to have questions from you. But I think we know where you are. Members know where you are. But I want to thank you for your presentation. I want to thank the members for being patient with me as I go through this process as your new chair. We have had a robust discussion, and I really appreciate it. So in saying that, I'm going to adjourn. We are done.